Today is Rosh Chodesh Elul. We will reconvene at the next new month for Rosh Hashanah. I want to share with you a story that I read about 2 weeks ago in thinking ahead towards the holiday. If I recall, this story occurs in Jerusalem on a bus. There were the two fellows who knew each other from a congregation in South Jerusalem. One was not quite fond of the other, but would observe him from afar. One day they were on a bus together, boarding the same bus, and the second fellow was behind the line, behind an elderly gentleman, and said, Sir, you've dropped some money. And the gentleman said, No, it's not mine. It must not be mine. It must be someone else's. And the first gentleman, the colleague, said, No, sir, you've dropped some money. Don't forget to pick it up, and handed it to him. That was all uneventful. A couple weeks later, he saw the same gentleman in the Super Soul in the local supermarket, behind an elder woman pushing a carriage, someone maybe with not much in her basket. And behind her in line, he said, Ma'am, you seem to have dropped some money. There's a 100 shekel bill that you must have dropped. No, it's not me. I don't know where that comes from. I don't know it's not me. No, I'm sure you dropped this. It must have come from your pocket. Here, take it. Use it to pay your bills. To which the observer noted that he had never quite liked the man, and it was a shame that it took those two instances for fondness to grow in his heart. It was really a mark, not just a mark of positive for that other man, but a negative mark against the observer, that he required proof that in this person's heart was good. A lot of Parshat Re'eh addresses questions of poverty. I think it's very interesting. So there are two parshiot that address kashrut. Marianne read lovingly from them today, all those odd names of birds and others that we can't eat, the duchifat, the hupo, among others. And the other parsha is Shmini. So Re'eh, as is common in Deuteronomy, talks about clearing your communities of things that would perturb it. And in this parsha, especially after the part we read, how to address poverty. Some of its measures are quite antithetical to what economists would do to effectively address poverty, but nonetheless, it is the concern about the poor, the indebted, the vulnerable. Parshat Shmini, the other place where we read about the issues of kashrut, addresses the aftermath of the death of Nadav and Avihu, what we do with tragedy. And there's a lot to be made about that. What I want to speak to you about particularly this week is Rosh Hashanah and the phrase we hear again, ut shuva, ut daka, ut fila, mavirim et roa hagezerah, that tshuva, repentance, return, staka, charitable giving, and tfila will reduce the severity of the evil decree held against us. We'll get to tzedakah at the end. That's the wraparound. So I want to talk about tshuva. At my best with the kids, when they hit each other, I don't just discipline them. I look to ways that they can make amends to each other. That's tshuva to me, is the ways in which we amend ourselves and the ways in which we make amends to fellows to repair both the world and our relationship. So this week's parasha starts with this beautiful phrase, Re'eh anochi noten lifnechem ayom bracha uklala. Look, behold, today I give before you blessing and curse. There were a series of early Aramaic translations of Hebrew Bible, I think they were roughly 1,500 and more years ago, and one of them translates it roughly as, see, I give you today blessing and its transmutation. That's the potential of tshuva. As you may know, when I speak to non-Jewish groups, for example, recently a chaplaincy group, one of the things I love to illustrate about our tradition is we don't believe in original sin. We don't believe that any person is fundamentally flawed or irredeemably flawed because we believe in tshuva, the possibility of repair, not through an intermediary, not through Jesus, not through prayer, but through action in this world, transmuting what we've done wrong, changing ourselves, changing the relationships among our communities, changing the things we do for the future. As Maimonides would note, noticing the things we've done wrong, addressing them, and ensuring that we don't repeat the mistake. And what tshuva requires in a modern age is a lot of reflection. You can't do it without at least a grain, if not a mountain, of self-awareness. We all have blind spots, and we have to be brought to awareness, either by ourselves, by a reflective practice, by a friend, sometimes even by an enemy, of the places we need to grow. So our tradition, as you know, is an intellectual tradition, a tradition of thought and practice and debate and discourse. So to tell another story, I have a friend who's now a colleague in Greenville. When I met him, he was a mere carpenter. It is not Jesus. Just to clarify, I'm not talking about Jesus. And we get those phrases, you know, you can only eat things with fins and scales. He would say, comma, or garlic and butter. That was the way he wanted to remediate the verse. I'm not an ichthyologist. I'm not a zoologist. I don't know anything about fish. I don't particularly like to eat fish. But the Talmud says this. So again, I always take its science with something of a grain of salt, but they seem to have known fish. So I don't know the Venn diagram, but it tells me that all fish that have scales have fins, but there are fish with fins and not scales. So this is a fact. Okay. So if you have scales, is it true that if you have scales, you always have fins? Ted's response is mine. Like, I don't know, I'm not going to eat those. Those are yuck. So the Torah could have said, says our Talmud, just simply scales, because scales includes the category of fins. So why snapir v'kan kaskeset? Why fins and scales? So when the sages have no great answer to why the Torah is redundant or adds superfluous language, their answer is often this particular answer. It is so that Torah be increased and made great. It's not just that the Torah be increased and made great by having too many words, but that it be increased and be made great by pilpul, by discussion, by dialectic, by striving with the words. That we study Torah gives us opportunities to learn. And that's a piece of tshuva, an opportunity to learn about yourself, about the things you do, about the things others around you do, about your role in the small world in which you live, and the larger world. So that's tshuva. I'm going to talk about tefillah, the second of the triumvirate of things that can prepare you in Elul for Rosh Hashanah and prepare you to ameliorate the harshness of what may be ahead of you. You know, I don't believe in God with the ledger. I do believe there is an accounting. I do believe that the world cares about our actions, that the divine is aware of us. And I don't think God punishes and rewards in some of the ways we traditionally look. That requires a belief in providence in a way that I don't share. But our chapter, our parsha, tells us in the beginning of chapter 14 that we are God's children. So the Tanya, the Alter Rebbe, the first of the Lubavitch rabbis, first of that dynasty in Lubavitch, Poland, says that the soul of a Jew is part of God. And just as a child is derived from the brain of the parents, the spirit of the parents, the physicality of the parents, it was an idea before it became a thing, and it was reverentially connected to our DNA, and we are microcosms of both our parents, but according to Tanya and elsewhere, microcosms of the divine. The soul of every Jewish person is derived from the mind and wisdom of God. That's the thing we aspire to when we pray, is to reignite or to rediscover that connection, to be again a part of the mind of God. As one of the, I think it was a chancellor of JTS, Finkelstein, said, when I pray, I speak to God. When I study, God speaks to me. But that's tefillah, that dialogue with God. The tshuva is sort of the internal reflexive dialogue, the desire to know ourselves better, repair our thoughts and actions, and tefillah is a beginning or a grasping at the dialogue with God. I just learned this one. Aquinas gave up writing a book because he had a dream that he was scooping from the sea with a teaspoon, and an angel came to him and said, Thomas, what are you doing? And he said, theology. So he gave up on theology because he realized it was scooping water with a teaspoon from the ocean. That said, I'm still not giving up on theology. I still care deeply about trying to understand my relationship, our corporate relationship and covenant with God, with what is above us. And the Baal Shem Tov, the forerunner of the Hasidic revival movement in Eastern Europe, said that God gives physical form to the spiritual, that we are, in case there is some spirit that precedes us, there is some idea or concept or Platonic ideal that precedes these bodies, and we are embedded in them, we are incarnate in them. Again, there's no body and soul dualism per se, but we are spirit made flesh, and the Jew makes spiritual the physical. We pray, we eat, we have intimate relations with our spouse, we are careful with our words, we give to charity, we participate in Jewish communities, physical embodied acts that, as we know, that's why we have mitzvot, that's why we have brachot over those acts of eating an apple. We, as a people, recognize the spirituality within the physical, and nowhere, I think, more so than in prayer, than, God willing, engaging with the liturgy, taking three steps back, three steps forward, bowing, shuckling, letting the prayer reverberate within us. I don't know, I was sort of debating to make this sermon about, like, what's the hardest of the three, you know? I guess it probably varies for each person. I'm going to include with one that's very hard for me, which is tzedakah. And I think I know why, and I think we all know why, maybe haven't named why tzedakah is hard. So when we look at tshuva, the internal, tefillah, the dialogue, and tzedakah, our relationship to our society, in a way, as expressed sometimes through the individuals that we know, that we cross, the parsha says in chapter 14, you must open your hand to the poor. You must serve the poor and extend yourself even to providing all of his or her needs. We see that also when you remit or manumit a serf, that you have to give them like a going away package. Sort of like, what do they call it in The Price is Right? Showcase Showdown? Yeah, you know, they had to provide the serf on his or her way out with a showcase according to his or her needs. And here we have very explicitly in very concrete and definitive Hebrew language, and I have to go into grammar to explain to you why it's so severe, you must certainly open your hand to the poor. So Rabbi Elazar in the Talmud, and this story is also told of Isaac Luria, one of the leading Kabbalists of the 15th century, that if he were want to pray, if it were time to pray, and you were desiring to say, let's say, the afternoon prayer, and a poor person came to him and needed something, he would not pray yet. He would address that person's needs. It doesn't say, we talked about this in Judaism 101, there's no hierarchy of mitzvot. There's a great, strong tradition that we don't try to estimate what one mitzvah is worth relative to another. I don't think this is to say that tzedakah is worth more than tefillah, it's just more compelling. Because I'm just pointing to you because you're here, God forbid, Bernard were a poor person and asked something of me, he is in my face. God, as we know, sees all but is not seen. Right? So I have to address that which is before me first. That's what Rabbi Elazar, I think, is getting at. That is, I know what Isaac Luria was suggesting. This is before me. The Kabbalah, the cosmos, is harder to perceive, but this is immediate. And, you know, it's kind of nice, actually, this worked out great for me. I have a prop, a pushke, our tzedakah box. Maimonides says that he has never been to a community that didn't have a charitable fund. That is so essential to who we are. We, in the modern era, we talk about tikkun olam, but really, tzedakah, acts of righteousness from Deuteronomy onward, are part of our DNA, that we are enjoined to do righteously. So I know with great regret that I don't give enough to charity. I feel it in my bones. And I know why it is too, and I think we all sort of know why we don't give enough. And I'm not pointing fingers, I just think no one gives as much as they could, you know. Hizkuni knows it too, one of our medieval sages. he talks about, relative to these verses about serving the poor, Torah warns you not to think about the economic hardship you might suffer for being good-hearted. That's it. I mean, I think that's the reason we don't give. We're all afraid. What's going to happen next week if I need the money? It's all well and good to give to a charity, to a person, to the synagogue, but what's going to happen next week when the check is gone? I don't get it back. I gave this poor person my last $20 bill. Oh, what if my car breaks down on the way back? It's scary to give. I don't know how to put that in a context that helps. I mean, I think that's a piece of the message of tshuva, tefillah, and tzedakah, to remind us these are three big ones that really repair your life, that make you better as a person, happier as a human, and better as a Jew, and more getting right with God. But they're not easy. Self-reflection isn't easy. Praying well isn't easy. And giving up your worldly goods is scary. All of them are kind of scary. So I'm looking into the possibility of starting a family fund at KJCFF. Partly because the advice that's always been given to me is ensure that you're giving money before you do anything else. And have that, for example, taken out of your salary before, you know, just like you would savings. Take out your pension contribution before you get your salary. Take out your savings before you get to salary. Take out your kids' college fund before you get to salary. Likewise, charity. Do it first. And I think that's what I'm hoping will be a benefit of working with the KJCFF. And I recommend that or something like that to you. The KJCFF is we are so lucky to have it. Scott's been president. Has anyone else in the room been an officer? Oh, yeah. We have many great institutions, but that is the one I see where we really punch above our weight. It's so unusual for any Jewish community. It's, as Maimonides says, it's very common for them to have a pushka, a charity fund. It's very unusual for a Jewish community to have a family of funds, and we are blessed. So tshuva, tefillah, and tzedakah, do them this month. Don't wait until Rosh Hashanah. And I want to leave you with a little bit of push from our tradition. So the Talmud, very similar in this, right next door to the last thing I read in the Talmud, gives this story about poverty, because the last third or so of Re'eh is about poverty. 10 powerful things were created in the world. Mountains are hard, but iron cuts through them. Iron is hard, but fire melts it. Fire is strong, but water extinguishes it. Water is strong, but clouds carry it. Clouds are strong, but wind scatters them. Wind is strong. Oh, I should have skipped this part. The body contains it. The body is strong, but fear breaks it. Fear is potent, but wine dispels it. Wine is powerful, but sleep assuages it. Yet stronger than all of these is death. But charity delivers from death. I never preach about something that isn't hard for me too. I never point fingers unless I know I'm also pointing the finger at me. I struggle to do tshuva. I struggle to pray, and I struggle to give tzedakah. I don't think I'm alone. If you're lucky, maybe only two of those things are hard for you. Do your best. Elul is beckoning you to dig into these mitzvot. Rosh Hashanah is here in one more cycle of the moon. You guys don't have to write sermons, so you can work on tshuva, tefillah, and tzedakah exclusively.